Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now, I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word. So I'm delighted to be joined today by Ting Wu, who is a geneticist and a social educator. She is the professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School. She's the director of the Consortium for Space Genetics, which we're going to get into, and is the co-founder and director of the Personal Genetics Education Project. So Ting has been at the heart of understanding the scientific and societal impact of genetics on the human experience, and some fascinating projects and experiences to dive into. Ting, welcome to the pod.
Thank you. I'm very honored to be here.
Well, it's very fun. So you do some pretty wild and wacky cutting edge science in various fields. We were talking a little bit before we kicked off around some of the work you're doing to understand the genome visually. And of course, back in the not really the dark ages, but the time of Rosalind Franklin and Crick and Watson, you know, we were getting these then extraordinary images from X-ray crystallography that now we look at and you sort of squint and you can say, "Ooh, is that really?" Like, tell us, where have we got to these days? What can we actually see when we look at the genome in extreme close-up?
Thank you for giving me this opportunity to share what my lab does. I have a wonderful lab, very playful, very bold. And several years ago, we realized that the genetics we'd been doing, the traditional genetics with fruit flies, pushing them around under the microscope, although that kind of genetics can give us base pair resolution in terms of mutations and beautiful sensitivity through looking at phenotypes, we wanted to actually see the chromosome itself. And so we started off, Ben Williams, a graduate student in my lab, came up with an idea of using oligos. They are synthesized DNAs at that time. They were pretty short at that time. Then Brian Beliveau and Eric Joyce joined my laboratory. Brian was a graduate student and Eric was a postdoc. And together they made this idea work into what we call oligo paints. And what oligo paints are oligos that we order from a company. They're synthesized. They just line the chromosomes and we attach indirectly fluorophores to those oligos. And therefore the chromosome glows beautifully. I was mentioning to you before we started this that we love just looking at the genome. The genome is beautiful. And at high resolution, you can see the twists and the turns and the knots. You can look at the maternal part of the genome and the paternal part of the genome and ask, how do the maternal paternal parts of the genome correlate with each other? Do they communicate? In one system, we have the chromosomes actually touching each other, like side by side. What are the things that keep us up at night? Of course, they're beautiful, but they vary. They're hugely dynamic. We see one particular region in endless number of forms. And I guess I don't even think it's even daring to say anymore. People believe that the variability of the genome is possibly encoding itself, part of what the genome does for us. So you know how we think about DNA as these linear arrays of bases. And when those bases change, that's a variant or a mutation. We pay attention to that. Well, in contrast to that, the way the chromosome folds up is highly variable all the time. And that variation may be critical for its function.
So the 3D space in which this is all folded up, the way that it is folded may be meaningful. We're suggesting that there's a parallel to the way that proteins fold and yes. And their function. There's been all of the discussion recently around AlphaFold and using
AI and machine learning to understand protein folding. Is that maybe the next challenge in this space to understand?
That is the challenge right now. You are exactly right. And I might add that one of the most exciting things about genetics is it's heritable from parent to child. One of the breakthroughs that has been a long time coming, but I think people have accepted now, is that the environment, a person's experience, can actually alter our genetic material and have it passed on to progeny. So what could some of those alterations be that the environment imposes that children then can inherit and for generations after that inherit? We wonder actually if it's part of that is the way the chromosome is folded, because of the folding, the 3D structure can be very sensitive to environmental onslaught, temperature changes, chemical changes. So it may be that when our grandchildren or even children think about what is the heritable material, they will say it's the nucleic acids and the proteins on it and the 3D organization of those molecules.
Wow, that's amazing. I remember when I was first getting into this field and learning a ton about genetics, genomics, and the metaphor that stuck in my mind was, if you think of our DNA as kind of a piece of string that goes from, let's say, London to New York, the genes are like sort of beads that sit along that string, and then the rest of the string that doesn't have beads is kind of the non-coding regions and so on. But actually, the metaphor shouldn't be the string that stretches from London to New York. It should be the string that is stretched out with all these beads and then compressed into some crazy kind of ball of wool, right?
Yes, that's what we're thinking about. It's extremely exciting, and partly because we really know so little about it.
Wow. So yeah, this is right at the far end of fundamental science. If we can solve these puzzles, though, what do you think we would be able to do with that understanding?
I think we may have a much better picture of what parents pass on to children. We may have a much better understanding of why diseases develop. And then, of course, close behind that is how understanding of those sorts of events can help us, especially in the case of disease, mitigate the consequences of disease, or perhaps even the reduce the occurrence of disease. It also may allow us to live in extreme environments more easily. Understanding, it's hard to predict where understanding takes us, because it always is more than we think it's going to give us.
Absolutely. That's the magic of science, and I guess sort of compound learning, isn't it? That we never know what we're going to learn.
Yes. And I think that always the next generation of scientists come in, they don't carry the baggage we carry that makes us biased. They come in with a new set of eyes. So the fascinating thing is when you bring someone in who's just learning what you've done and realize that they're coming at it in a different way and they're going to carry it further than you could carry it yourself. That is, I think, one of the most exciting things about being in science, is seeing the next generation supersede what you've done.
Super exciting. And speaking of frontier science, I have to ask about the Consortium for Space Genetics. I was looking at the website for that, and it says the Consortium for Space Genetics embodies three missions: to protect human health in space as well as on Earth, sustain our planet and the many life forms that it supports, and promote exploration so that we may better understand the vastness and potential of our universe. And I thought, I don't know if I've ever read a more inspiring kind of mission statement than that. This is incredible. So how did this arise, and what is the consortium doing these days?
So the story of how it arose is Adam Stelzner, who works at JPL, is the person who put Curiosity on Mars. He and his team put Curiosity on Mars. And he and I were speakers at at an event where people from different walks of life came and spoke. So I had the honor of being, and the difficulty of being on the same platform he was on. So I got up and I talked about genetics, and I got some polite applause. And then he got up and talked about putting Curiosity on Mars. And I was standing in the audience cheering. It was so inspiring. But we happened to pass each other in the hallway, and I asked him whether NASA, JPL, was incorporating genetic information to help them help astronauts endure space. And he so on top of it, and he said, we have to talk about this. So I got to know him. And then on a whim, I sent him a message, and I said, you know, I would love to share your point of view with our department. Would you mind coming to give a symposium? And he answered right away, yes, which was very exciting. So I made the announcement to our department of genetics that Adam Stelzner was coming to speak. And the overwhelming response from graduate students and postdocs, well, the response was more than I think I've ever seen in my whole life in science. Usually people write back and say, yes, oh, that's great. Thank you for inviting me. I got emails that were 2 or 3 pages long talking about how that was the kind of exploration they went into science to do.
I was going to say, it talks to the kid in all of us, right?
Yes, and thank you. Finally, I know that science is what I thought it was going to be. So well, the event turned into a day-long symposium. And part of that, we invited people to come up and speculate about how their work would pertain to space. And they could do whatever they wanted. So 7 faculty signed up to speak, which was more than anyone had anticipated. And the talks were funny. We asked them to really speculate. They were funny. They were intense. And after that, people said, was that it? So the consortium just formed. We have, I can't even say annual because I'm not that organized.
Periodic.
Periodic. Oh, that's good. I love that. The periodic conference on space genetics. The last one we did was actually focused very much on climate change because Earth is in space after all.
It sure is. And what are some of the either questions the teams have been asking or insights they've been discovering through the work?
So it is very much work that we do to take care of people on Earth, to take care of our planet, take care of the environment on Earth. But people are still people when they go in space. So a lot of what we learn about health can go into space. For example, DNA repair, a lot of work having to do with disease detection, a lot of work having to do with understanding how people respond to stress. My lab in particular is very concerned about the issue of radiation. There are 2 things we need to concern ourselves with, or we will never leave the shell of Earth. One is the psychological demands on someone who's brought up on Earth, living in space. And the second one is radiation. And if we can't solve those problems, we will not, I've been told, get very far at all. So my lab is very interested in that aspect of protecting the genome against radiation. We have a model of an element in our bodies, in our genome, called ultra-conserved elements, not discovered by us, discovered by a few other labs. We think that they may be, I don't want to say secret, but highly underestimated sentinels of protecting the genome against damage. And so we're trying to understand how they work, because if we can induce them to work efficiently, they may be one key to helping astronauts repair their damage. The strategy we think they use is damaged cells are eliminated from the body well before disease happens.
Amazing. And I was reading a science fiction book a little while ago where the premise was humans had to leave the Earth in a hurry because the moon had been hit by something and had exploded. And so in 2 or 3 years from the beginning of the book, all of the moon material was going to hit the atmosphere of Earth and it was going to burn up and everyone had to get off. So we got 2 or 3 years to get off the planet. Really interesting concept. And in fact, they picked up on the radiation thing quite thoughtfully in that book, as not just the sort of space radiation, but also the nuclear radiation from having to power craft in that way. And they also got into some pretty speculative stuff around epigenetics. So how the genome is changed from these different interactions in space and the different pressures that we're putting the body under in these extreme circumstances. I don't know if that's purely the realm of science fiction. Do you think that we're starting to understand how the genome might itself be impacted through exposure to space?
Yes. So there are projects going on in labs, not my own, trying to understand how the genome responds to the different environment in space, how the epigenetic marks are put on, taken off, whether proteins and RNAs are made as faithfully and as efficiently, all kinds of physiological things that we take for granted on Earth, are they the same in space? For our imaging that we were talking about earlier, we are very interested to learn whether in the absence of gravity, these variable structures that we see, is it the same variable set of structures? Is it different? And different is not necessarily bad. Different means your genome is responding, which it's supposed to do, to take care of itself. There are all those questions need to be answered.
We've talked about some very cutting edge science, right? Visualizing the 3D structure of the genome in extreme high definition at the sort of handful of nanometers scale, thinking about the epigenetic effects of space on the human genome. Right at the other end of the spectrum, you're of course a founder and leading light in PGED, a sort of personal genetics education project, which is based out of Harvard. How do you bring someone who's not a postdoc in genomics on a journey to understanding more about these topics, about what they mean for them, what they mean for society?
It's actually, I don't think it's that hard to do, because people are smart. And I don't mean smart from having gone to science class and learned the vocabulary and the molecular biology of something. They're so smart about what's important in life, about what they need to be happy. Robert F. Kennedy had a wonderful quote about gross national product. And I really need to memorize it. In that quote, he said, countries measure their gross national product in very mundane and measurable ways. And it's a very gripping quote. But he says, how do we measure, I'll have to paraphrase, the quality of life, the joy of life, the love of family, all that. And so that people are so smart in. And so what PGED does is I don't think people are interested in general in how the molecules are shaped or how DNA, the steps of DNA repair. They want to know, what is that going to do to my life? Mm-hmm. And so what we found early on is that if we focus our discussion of genetics on the pieces we haven't figured out. Is this good for us? Is this going to make us better people? Oftentimes we walk in, we say maybe about 10 minutes worth, and the rest is conversation. And that's what they ask, is the level that we need to know to have these important conversations. You know, in the lab we say, oh, what enzyme does that? Or what's the actual distance between here and here? And the questions we get when we talk with people is, where is this going? Where did this come from? Can this help my child? If we do help my child, how is life going to change for my child? Do I have input? Is there enough acceptability in our community to have a diversity of opinions, to allow us all to live the life the way we want to live it? And I think those are the big issues. We need to hear from all communities so scientists can properly design their experiments and invent to help.
You've talked about diverse communities there, and you used a phrase which in the current global pandemic seems almost archaic, which is when people walk in. I guess a couple of questions. Which communities have you been engaging, and how have you reached out to them, both, I guess, before the current situation and in the current context of everyone being sort of remote?
So it started off by my lab realizing that we were not hearing what people were saying about what was going on in genetics. And so I would say more there, we are just very grateful for being able to go to a classroom. We started working in classrooms and hearing, I love the sophomore age. Sophomores are a fantastic group to talk to, the honesty with which they told us what they thought. Now, what they said varied a lot depending on the community. So a wealthy community. If you asked them about genetics, some of them would have done 23andMe, would have gotten their genome analyzed in some way. We'd be talking about companies, other communities, the disenfranchised communities, communities of color in particular. They would not have heard as much. And the really gritty things they would say, very contrasted very differently. How is this being used for law enforcement?
Yeah.
How is this being used to help me? One student said, where are you getting all your funding from? And when I explained about the NIH and taxes, she very astutely said, so you mean that my mother, who doesn't have health care, is paying taxes to have you do things that will never help her? And the answer to that is yes.
Yeah.
And that is why we have to talk to these communities, because their insight will tell us what is important to focus on. And we have an obligation to, I hope, generate a greater sense of, I don't want to say trust, because trust is a very, very special word to say. You have to earn it. We need somehow to, let's say, strengthen the confidence of some communities to come and ask questions, and then perhaps be more willing to consider certain technological strategies to addressing disease.
You talked earlier about how we can build the insights from these conversations with different communities into the work that scientists and doctors and other professionals do. What have you learned about the challenges and opportunities of trying to actually do that?
So I'll give you a very, it's not a very inspiring answer. I believe we have figured out that sincerity, transparency, absolute honesty is, it magnifies, it augments, it takes on a life of its own, and so it's not difficult. Conversation is key. Putting yourself out there and not having an agenda. Just want to get to know someone, and you would like them to get to know you and what's happening. We have online curricula, we have teacher training. But I think what we really are trying to do is just to have a conversation. What holds us up? What's the most difficult thing? Funding.
Right.
Someone once said, Ting, if I gave you enough money for 200 people, what would you do? How long would it take you to use it? I said, those 200 people could be engaged within a month. We have many, many geneticists all over the world. And as they see what's unfolding these days, I would say, especially the younger generation of geneticists coming up, they've grown up with this sense of responsibility.
Yeah.
I am fairly sure that we have thousands, thousands of geneticists who are willing to work with their community. And it's best for a geneticist who is a geneticist in a community working that way to have grown up there, to know that community. At the same time, it's important to work from the other end. So PGED does a lot of work. We've done congressional briefings. It's important to work with the leadership, because if the population has a certain sense or feeling, but the leadership is not in the same wavelength, we will not be able to advance our mission, the world's mission, everybody, not just PGED's mission, very well. So we do congressional briefings, and we're going to, we have plans now to increase that. Finally, we work with filmmakers, television producers. They have, we've made some connections. Sometimes we do consulting with them. And I'm hoping this year, depending on our ability to support this, we would like to engage, not a lot, but a key set of producers, writers. Writers are brilliant, to help put out pieces, they can be fictional, that at least makes more of the population think, wait, scientists are not just the people that are generally portrayed as doing unfortunate things to our planet, but that they are made up of people with very sincere desires to do good. So just to improve that conversation, I guess I'm going back and answering your earlier question. We also work with communities of faith.
Right.
Communities of faith are, they for generations have developed, have a way of connecting with their community. And so we work with them to learn from them and to also partner with them to reach communities that we may not be able to otherwise reach.
That's incredible. The film and TV point, I think, is so important because I'm a big believer that storytelling is how we as humans really learn and engage and get excited and get afraid and get, fired up. And the ability to tell stories about our work in this space and to listen to the response that we get to those stories, I think is so fundamental to how we as a whole field move forward.
I agree with you. And that was one of the reasons I think journalists, people do podcasts such as yourself, they also have a talent for understanding how to get messages out, elicit or encourage certain feelings that people have. Yeah, we are very honored to work with people who are expert in this area of communication. Most recently, PGED has just developed a formal partnership with the Genetics Society of America. We're really hoping that by working with GSA, we will have a more direct conduit to this younger generation of geneticists coming up who will be able to help us reach all these other communities.
That's amazing. And if we get this right, if we get some of the science right, if we get some of the engagement right, the listening, the storytelling, what could you picture changing in, let's say, 10 years' time?
That's a tough question, but a really exciting one. In 10 years' time, right now, and I think this is very much, it will seem like it's fueled by the recent events of our world, but is actually one of the fundamental reasons we started PGED. We would like people to have a better understanding of the differences between them, to understand that differences are differences. We can celebrate them. Communities are proud of their heritage. It's okay to say, wow, there's my great-grandma and great-grandpa, and they came from these different places, without judging those differences. Differences and judgment are two separate things. Judgment is a choice, and differences can be informative, for health especially. So I hope we will have a much better understanding of what understanding the genome can do for us to make us better as versus to divide us. It's been a difficult, difficult year. And that is what I'm hoping will be.
I think if we can be in a place in 10 years' time where, as you say, we understand more and more about not just what the genome is and how it works, but I love your phrase of what it can do for us, how it can help us to solve real world problems, whether that's around learning about diseases and treatments, helping humanity survive on other planets, all of these potential things, right? It's what can the genome do for us in a huge amount.
Yes, and I think in order to reach that point, we must somehow get beyond our current view of what the genome means in terms of who we are and our potential. It's the genome can tell us a lot about how we can take care of ourselves, how we can take care of other people. It's information, and currently it's being used well in some methods, and of course I'm showing where I personally come from, but it is being, I would like to say, misused or misunderstood in other ways. And that is partly the problem of geneticists who have not worked hard enough to properly explain what genetics really is. Let's see, we have fallen short of having these conversations. And so that's where PGED is really hoping we can do something.
Well, that's hugely inspiring. I'm conscious that we're pretty much up on time. I feel like I would very happily continue this conversation for about 3 hours.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series. I'd appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.